Welcome to History Counts. History provides the roadmap to the future. If you want to know where you're going, you have to know where you've been. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. Today, the United States finds itself embroiled in a bloody and divisive war in Iraq. U.S. relations with Iran are close to war. How did this come about? Is it the result of recent policy decisions, or is it the fruit of long historical trends? As you will learn in today's edition of History Counts, intervention by Western powers in the Middle East is not new. In fact, it goes back almost a century to World War I and the treaties that ended it. Please join us as we examine the origins of Western intervention in the Middle East with our guest, Professor David Frommkin, renowned historian and author of A Peace to End All Peace, the classic work on the creation of the modern Middle East. This is Ken McDermott Rowe, and you're listening to History Counts. Our subject today is the origin of the modern Middle East nation-states. To help us understand how these states came into being, we're very fortunate to have as our guest today Professor David Frommkin, author of A Peace to End All Peace, The Fall of the Ottoman Empire and the Creation of the Modern Middle East. David Frommkin is Professor of International Relations, History, and Law at Boston University, where he served for 6 years as founding director of the Pardee Center for the Study of the Longer-Range Future. Before entering academia, Professor Frommkin spent much of his professional life as a practicing attorney. He was the head of foreign policy for Hubert Humphrey in his 1972 presidential primary campaign, and he's been a member of the Council on Foreign Relations since 1976. A Peace to End All Peace was a national bestseller in 1989 and was on the short list for the Pulitzer Prize. Professor Frommkin, thanks very much for being with us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
In terms of a modern map, what geographic area does A Peace to End All Peace concern, and what years are covered?
The modern Middle East emerged from the First World War in the years, therefore, that began in 1914 and went up to the early 1920s. The area that it covers is essentially from Egypt on the west to Iraq, and some would say Afghanistan on the east.
So this would also include the modern states of Iraq, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, Saudi Arabia, as well as Egypt?
Yes, as well as the modern state of Turkey.
Tell us about the Ottoman Empire and its role in the Middle East just before World War I.
The Ottoman Empire was named for a warlord named Osman. Osman Lee became Ottoman. The Ottoman Empire began as a warrior band that went from conquest to conquest, eventually capturing the great city of Constantinople, then the head of the center of the Byzantine Empire. And the Ottomans expanded at a great rate, and at their furthest went as far as the gates of Vienna. So the Ottoman Empire ruled much of the Balkans and Eastern Europe, and the Arab-speaking Middle East, again, all the way from Egypt. And indeed, at the height of the empire included Algeria and the rest of North Africa.
Although the Ottoman Empire was still very extensive, by the turn of the century, it was getting very weak, was it not? And the Europeans were anticipating its demise?
Yes, the Ottoman Empire was in a long retreat, and it was indeed expected by European statesmen that at some point the Ottoman Empire would collapse, would disintegrate, might well be divided amongst the great powers, or whatever.
What were Britain's regional interests in the Middle East?
Now, Britain's main interest was in protecting her road to India. That was the crown, the jewels in the crown of empire, and to protect it and the Suez Canal, which was the short route to get on east to India. Those were her main interests.
Britain was particularly concerned about Russian influence expanding in the region?
Yes, Russia and France were the two big empires that threatened Britain. There was a great rivalry between them in the 19th century. Between them, they were the three largest empires in the world, and they were very large indeed. Britain itself, the British Empire, covered roughly 25% of the globe.
Was oil a factor yet?
No, it wasn't. It was just starting in 1911, when Churchill, then the civilian head of the British Navy, switched the fleet from coal to oil. And that was a significant date. But it was only towards the end of the First World War, just afterwards, that oil started to become a great feature of politics in the area.
You quote Sir Mark Sykes, the British official, in 1914, saying, quote, "The disappearance of the Ottoman Empire must be the first step towards the disappearance of our own," end quote. What does this say about the attitude of the British towards the Ottoman Empire before World War I?
The British Empire saw its role as propping up the Ottoman Empire just before the First World War, keeping it going, keeping it in its territorial integrity, and making sure that it remained independent and that it was not gobbled up by Russia and others.
So it was a useful buffer against the expansion of Russian influence south or other
yes.
Europeans.
Yes, it was.
But then World War I comes, and the Ottoman Empire, the Turks, ally themselves with the Germans. And this is a catalyst for the change in policy?
Yes, it was.
And what was the new policy that was developed by people like Sir Mark Sykes and Lord Kitchener?
In the First World War, Britain was allied with Russia and with France. Not rivals, but allies. And the Russians insisted that for them to continue staying on into the war, remaining an ally to Britain, Britain and France would have to promise that Russia would get Constantinople as the spoils of victory. That was resisted by the French, but the British finally had their way and indeed agreed to let Russia have Constantinople after the war. But in turn, what that meant is that to counterbalance that, Britain saw that she and France would both have to have some sort of equivalent gains in the Middle East as well.
So instead of maintaining the Ottoman Empire as a weak buffer state, they wanted to actually start to take control of the region.
Yes.
Now, they needed the help, or they sought the help of the Arabs during World War I. What did they want the Arabs to do for them? And what did the Arabs expect to get in return?
There were different officials in Great Britain, different politicians, different people with different goals and different ideas. So the study of what happened in that area is a study of conflicting people with conflicting views. One group, essentially headed by the officers who served under Lord Kitchener, the Minister of War, looked forward to a Middle East after the war in which the rivalry with Russia and France would continue. And in order to be effective in that competition, Kitchener's people thought in terms of backing a holy man of their own who would be essentially the leader of the Muslim religion as caliph. That was the way they understood the Muslim religion was led. And they thought what they should have is their own man as caliph who could be on their side in bidding for the allegiance of the Arab-speaking world. So that was one group of people. And then that merged into the first group. Another group believed in Arab nationalism. They believed that roughly half of the Ottoman army fighting in the war really were in favor of Arab national unity, and that those people might be prepared to make a deal with Britain in which case half of the Ottoman army would come over to the Allied side of the war and win the war in the east for Britain. So that was another group. Yet another group did not believe that these plans for Arab support for Great Britain had any reality.
The local leader that they were dealing with was Hussein, was he not? A leader in West Arabia whose reign included Mecca and Medina?
Yes, Hussein and his sons were the ones on whom most of the British placed their hope. Although another not unimportant group of British officials, the ones out of British India, preferred to back Ibn Saud, who was emerging as the paramount lord of the Arabian Peninsula.
And that's the family that ultimately did get control.
Yes.
But now, in negotiating with Hussein, were they negotiating with someone who represented the grassroots, or was this a negotiation with an ambitious ruler who wanted to enlarge his kingdom?
Essentially, they were making a mistake, because Hussein had no significant backing within the Arab world or within the Muslim world.
So it was really an attempt on his part to enlarge his kingdom.
He was vicious. To begin with, what he wanted was was to make his position in Arabia hereditary. He held his office as an appointee of the Ottoman Empire. He wanted to be the ruler forever, for himself, for his sons, for his grandsons.
So he would break free the Ottomans, and he would become, in fact, in charge.
Yes.
Was there any group that the British could have negotiated with other than him who would have represented the grassroots, the popular element, Arabia?
Well, now, a lot of speculation has to go into this, even more than in most what-if kind of historical questions. There was a small militant group in the Arab world who claimed to represent Arab opinion. So far as modern scholars have been able to find out, we're talking about maybe a few hundred people, most of them army officers, out of a population of 25 million. At that time, there was nobody, so far as we could tell, who really could speak for the Arab world.
Well, while the negotiations with Hussein were going on, there were also secret negotiations going on between France and Britain, in which led to the Sykes-Picot Treaty. Could you talk about that treaty and what it decided?
Well, of course, France had been one of the pre-war rival of Britain for the Arab-speaking Middle East. France, as a principal ally, had a veto right. The two allies, Britain and France, had agreed to essentially focus on the Western Front in Europe. To change that, which the British now wanted to do in order to be able to have things they could use in bargaining with the Arabs, they had to agree for themselves on what Britain was going to get, what France was going to get. And so the two governments negotiated an agreement which essentially gave a kind of greater Syria, Lebanon, much of Palestine, to France, and to give what is now Iraq and confirming Egypt in the British sphere.
And Jordan and Arabia, were they covered by it as well?
Jordan was not an entity at that time. It was part of the Ottoman Empire, but it did not have a separate existence.
And what's now Saudi Arabia, would that go to the British?
No. They're really changing their views as to what they should do with it. The British Foreign Secretary, Sir Edward Grey, in particular, wanted an independent Arab state in what is now the Arabian Peninsula, and one which would therefore include Hussein's domain as protector of the holy place.
Did Britain or France consult with the Arab leaders while Sir Mark Sykes and François-Georges Picot negotiated the treaty?
No, they didn't. Didn't tell them about the negotiation, and afterwards they didn't tell them for quite some time that it had taken place.
Did the Arabs, in fact, help Britain in the war against the Turks in World War I?
Not significantly. There were groups, many of them associated with the wonderful figure of T.E. Lawrence of Arabia, did engage in guerrilla-type activities that were of help, but not of any really significant help.
In the military area, Britain launched a large offensive in 1917, which changed conditions on the ground in Egypt and what's now Iraq and Syria. Could you talk about that?
The new commanding British General of Forces in Egypt, General Allenby, launched two very successful offensives. The first one was one that led north towards the Syrian frontier, and then afterwards resumed the fighting there. The turning of the tides in the Middle East was a very cheering one for the British, and especially for the new British Prime Minister, David Lloyd George, who laid great hopes for a victory in the Arab world and who had a desire to see that the territorial gains were won in that part of the world.
So by the end of the war, the British had captured Jerusalem, Baghdad, Damascus, and you're right, had 1 million troops in the Ottoman Empire.
Yeah, as the war came to an end, there were slightly more than 1 million British troops in occupation.
So this gave the British and Lloyd George a dominant role in determining the future of the Middle East in the Versailles discussions?
Yes.
So how did Britain use its power?
Well, first of all, there was a conversation between the prime ministers of France and England in December 1918. The war ended, the armistice took place November of that year. Now, this is December. And the French prime minister was anxious to make sure that France had the support of Britain in the post-war world in keeping the Germans down now that they were defeated. that end, but French Prime Minister Clemenceau was prepared to make concessions to the British in the Middle East, which to him was of much lesser importance. So in a conversation with just the two men present, the French Prime Minister Clemenceau said to Lloyd George, "Well, what do you want?" And Lloyd George said, "Mosul." That's now oil-rich area in the north of what is now Iraq. "Fine, okay, what else do you want?" And the reply was Palestine. He shouldn't have said that's it, because he really wanted a third thing. He wanted the British, he wanted the French to get out, to not have Syria and Lebanon. And the French very badly wanted it. And that was the subject of wrangling during the peace conferences.
So essentially they were drawing, fabricating new nation states and drawing up their borders?
Yes, and was one of the fascinating things seeing in the very short time that elapsed how one group of states, the ones taken by Britain and France, how they emerged and how they evolved. And on the other hand, there were some countries in the Middle East that succeeded in winning their own independence and going on their own, and they had a quite different history going forward.
And which ones were they?
Saudi Arabia, created by Ibn Saud, the great warlord. The country we now call Turkey, whose independence was won by its great military hero, Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, and to some extent, Iran, which was led by an army colonel who seized power and independence.
These countries, as I understand it from your book, have varying degrees of independence. Some are actually outright controlled by the French or the British, and some were run by people who put them up. In the case of the Sauds, for example, you mentioned that like the Husseins, they were also on the British payroll.
Yes. British India had its approach and its strategy during the war and even slightly after. So did British Cairo. So in what we would call a civil war, but in the tribal war for control of the Arabian Peninsula, the British in Cairo were backing Hussein, and the British from India were backing Ibn Saud.
So from either perspective, the British were going to end up with someone who was sympathetic to them in charge of the country.
Well, also, but there was a certain absurdity in having the British subsidize two warlords who were fighting one another.
And when one looks at the settlements in the other countries, they all seem to be people who were essentially British surrogates. You have Hussein's son, Abdullah, in Jordan, another son, Faisal, in Iraq. And in Egypt, it's nominally independent, but you're right, it's still essentially controlled by the British as far as they're having troops there and running its foreign policy.
Yeah, and the British placed their man on the throne in Egypt.
And even in Persia, which wasn't the subject of the Sykes-Picot Treaty, you mentioned the Anglo-Persian Agreement gave Britain effective control of Persia.
Yes, it did.
What was the position of the United States in the Versailles Treaty?
The United States had come in late into the war and knew that the war was being fought in part for what we called selfish interests on the part of Britain and France. And the United States, under Woodrow Wilson, our very idealistic leader, announced we were declaring war on the same enemies. We were not allies of Britain and France. We were an associated power. And as far as the United States, in terms of its own interests, the President and Secretary of State told the Senate Foreign Relations Committee that our only interest as Americans was in protecting the two American missionary colleges that had been established.
Didn't Wilson believe that nation states should reflect the will of the population?
His name is always associated with people who should have the right to self-determination. I put it that way because Wilson qualified that statement to such an extent that, well, that you have to be careful to use it with all its qualifications.
The Arabs resisted, did they not? You mentioned that there was a general Syrian Congress organized under Faisal in 1920. How did the Europeans deal with the resistance?
Well, the French simply marched their own army in and took over.
In your view, was the World War I settlement successful from either the British or the Arab viewpoint?
To some extent, yes. To some extent, no. From the British point of view, it was successful because Britain had nominal control of the Middle East between the two world wars. And when the Second World War came, they were in a position to put down a pro-Nazi revolt in Iraq as well as a tendency on the behalf of the Egyptian king to also be against the Allies in the war. So the British had the strategic position. They had it for a quarter of a century. They had a position from which they were able to effectively fight in the Second World War. So they got something. I mean, whether it was worth the tremendous unpopularity they incurred throughout the Arab world, that's another question.
Did the United States essentially inherit the position of Britain in the Middle East?
In large part, yes. We made it in the early 1950s. We made an agreement with the British and restored the Shah of Iran to his throne. Immediately after the Second World War, we to take over British positions in the Eastern Mediterranean. So while claiming that we had different goals in mind, we did indeed take over the British position.
In terms of regional stability in the Middle East, do you think it would be desirable for a return of a large entity such as the Ottoman Empire, an entity which would be Arabic, not Turkish and Arabic, but primarily Arabic?
In other words, would it be a good idea if there were an entity Arab-speaking?
Well, the idea being that before World War II, the Ottoman Empire created a buffer and provided some degree of stability in the region, preventing foreign intervention, whether from the Russians in the north or from other powers coming from the west. Would such an entity be useful in the future, such as might develop out of an Arab League?
Yeah, obviously I don't know the answer to that. I do think that any such entity stands a far greater chance of gaining support if it were the creation of Arab-speaking people themselves, rather than some decision on our part in the West that some different form of government would be better for them.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Fromkin. You've been listening to History Counts, and we've been talking about the origins of the modern Middle East nation-states with Professor David Fromkin, author of A Peace to End All Peace, The Fall of the Ottoman Empire, and the Creation of the Modern Middle East. This is your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and I'll be right back. After World War II, three important trends emerge in the Middle East: the rise of United States power, the growing importance of oil, and the renewal of Western rivalry. First, let's look at how the United States eclipsed Britain as the leading Western power in the Middle East. Iran was a turning point here. In 1953, the British wished to overthrow the democratically elected government of Iran because its leader, Mohammad Mossadegh, had nationalized Britain's oil company. Unable to carry out the task by itself, Britain turned to the United States for help. The CIA obliged by overthrowing Mossadegh and installing the Shah, who was to protect the West's oil interests. In the aftermath, it became clear that the United States was now the senior Western power in the Middle East, with Britain as a junior partner. Second, control of oil became the West's principal goal in the Middle East, rather than the protection of the route to India. The United States, once the world's leading oil producer, found that it could no longer meet its energy requirements from domestic production. In 1970, the U.S. production began to decline, and shortly thereafter, an embargo by foreign oil-producing nations dealt a serious blow to the American economy. Thus, control of Middle East oil became seen as central to United States national security. Third, the Sykes-Picot Treaty did not lay to rest all Western rivalry in the Middle East. During the Cold War, the Soviet Union continued Russia's historic policy of southern expansion by attempting to forge alliances with Middle East nations. The United States and Britain countered with the formation of the anti-communist Baghdad Pact in 1955. The United States saw the Soviet Union's 1979 invasion of Afghanistan as a step towards Soviet hegemony in the Persian Gulf. The Carter administration responded in 1980 with a declaration that the United States would use military force if necessary to defend its national interest in the Persian Gulf. It's interesting to recall that Britain fought three wars in Afghanistan in the 19th and early 20th centuries to prevent Russia from expanding its influence south. How successful has the United States been in its role as Britain's successor in the Middle East? Let's look at the post-World War II history of Egypt, Iraq, and Iran, three of the most important countries in the region. In Egypt, the pro-Western monarchy was overthrown in 1952, and the new Republican government, under Gamal Abdel Nasser, nationalized the Suez Canal and pursued a foreign policy independent of the West. However, Egypt again came under Western influence following Nasser's death in 1967. Since 1981, the country has been ruled by pro-Western Hosni Mubarak, whose regime relies largely on American financial support. In Iraq in 1958, the pro-Western monarchy created by Britain was overthrown in a popular revolt. The new government of General Abdul Karim Qasim withdrew from the Baghdad Pact, opened diplomatic relations with the Soviet Union, and adopted a non-aligned stance. Qasim legalized the Communist Party, instituted agrarian reforms, supported Arab nationalist movements in Algeria and Palestine, and seized 98% of land owned by the British-controlled Iraqi oil company. He was overthrown in 1963 in a CIA-backed Ba'athist coup and killed the next day after a show trial. One of the men who attempted to assassinate Qasim was none other than Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein proved to be somewhat of a disappointment to the United States as he nationalized the Western-owned Iraq Petroleum Company in the 1970s. He was deposed by the United States and its allies in an invasion in 2003. Iran remained under the rule of the pro-Western Shah for 26 years until he was overthrown in 1978 in a revolution that produced an Islamic Republic. Iran's relations with the United States further deteriorated when Iranian students, fearing a CIA-backed coup, as in 1953, seized the U.S. Embassy in Tehran. In the 1980s, the United States and many other countries supported Iraq in an 8-year war against Iran, aimed at seizing oil fields in the Persian Gulf. Iran suffered between 500,000 and 1 million casualties in the war. The United States continues to have poor relations with Iran. The U.S. maintains a large fleet off Iran's coast, and both major American parties talk of war. The Sykes-Picot Treaty, imposed on the region by Britain and France at the end of World War I, still casts a long shadow. The dismemberment of the Ottoman Empire created a power vacuum in the Middle East, which continues to be an open invitation to foreign intervention and international conflict. Whether the nations of the Middle East will gain control of their own destiny, either individually or collectively, remains to be seen. Thank you for joining us. History Counts is broadcast on the first Thursday of the month at 12:30 p.m. and on the first Sunday of the month at 10 p.m. It's produced by MDR Productions, Inc. and engineered by David Schwartz. Please visit us at historycounts.org, where you can listen for free to an archive of our programs. Until next time, this is Ken McDermott Rowe for History Counts.